And we return 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Looks like we're going to have a rainy afternoon, Bonnie.
Again.
What's new? Well, today we begin with details about Viva Florida 500, which commemorates the arrival of Ponce de Leon, or as they say, Ponce de Leon, who of course gave our state its name. Joining us now is Dr. Michelle Williams. She directs the Florida Public Archaeology Network at Florida Atlantic University. Welcome to you, Dr. Williams. Thanks for joining us. Dr. Williams.
Okay.
Well, we also
have with us Melissa Memory. She's the Chief of Cultural Resources for Everglades and Dry Tortugas National Parks. And we thank you for joining us, Melissa.
Hi, glad to be here.
Dr. Williams, you there now?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Okay, good to have you. Well, Viva Florida 500's chock full of events and activities. Could you give us the lowdown?
What we're doing is we were trying to celebrate that moment when Ponce de Leon, or commemorate that moment, Ponce de Leon went to the Tortugas for the first time 500 years ago. So Melissa and I developed a three-day series of programs that we're going to be doing down in Key West in the Dry Tortugas on June 20th to the 22nd. The first thing we're going to be doing is a cemetery resource protection training. The next day, we're actually going out to the Dry Tortugas and doing hands-on programming there for visitors. And then on the 22nd, we have an archaeology lecture series that we're doing at the Florida Keys Echo Discovery Center.
Now, the cemetery business.
Exactly.
Would I drive to Key West to go look at old limestone tombstones?
There are a lot of people that are very interested in historic cemeteries. They're a moment in time, they're a commemorative place to be, but they also tell a history and a story that sometimes doesn't get written down anywhere else. So what this program is to help people, most of the participants that we have so far, actually live there in Key West and help them preserve the cemetery that they have. Cemeteries decay over time, and there's a lot of resources that are available to help you protect that cemetery for the next 100 years.
Now, is that Key West Cemetery, is it similar to the New Orleans ones where they're buried up above?
They are buried a little bit above ground, and some are in the ground, but yes, they have a water table issue just like they do in New Orleans.
They don't want to have any floaters.
No one does.
How do you preserve these tombstones or, you know, different aspects of the cemetery? Are there legal issues involved?
Absolutely, and that's what the whole cemetery resource protection training is about, is letting the participants know what the legal issues are, what are the legal issues locally, state level, federal level, and what are some of the techniques to preserve the gravestones, and also what can well-meaning people do to accidentally destroy gravestones. So that's what we're trying to do, is give the people there in Key West resources that they can use to protect their own cemeteries.
Melissa Memory, as an archaeologist, tell us of the unique aspects of the Dry Tortugas.
Well, for those...
Besides being dry.
Besides being dry, the Dry Tortugas, I think if listeners have been out there before, the first thing that most people think or even say when they get out there is, why is this giant fort out here? And certainly this event gives us an opportunity to talk about not just that moment in time and that marker in time where Ponce de Leon described and named the Tortugas, Las Tortugas, because of the rich abundance of turtles and other animals that live there, but also those that came before, and certainly the fabulous history that went on after, you know, including the lighthouse that was there prior to Fort Jefferson being constructed, the Fort Jefferson, of course.
Of course, there must be a lot of shipwrecks that are interesting there.
Yes. Well, that of course, is the story of the Dry Tortugas and the reason the lighthouse and the fort are there as well.
How is that holding up environmentally?
Well, we have challenges, to be honest, with protecting Fort Jefferson and the lighthouse just because of the storms, you know, and that have been ongoing since its construction.
Right.
We've just... almost completed with a multi-year stabilization project that has turned out to be a really a great demonstration of, you know, what we can do to protect these resources looking forward into the future. But we have a little bit more to go that we hope to start working on this year.
So Ponce arrived in 1513, mm-hmm. and that's almost 100 years before Jamestown. It's hard to fathom that. It's pretty interesting.
It is. You know, so many people think of Florida as being such a, quote, new state with not a lot of history. And certainly, you know, as an archaeologist, looking back over 10,000 years, you know, certainly the human history here has been tremendous. And we have really very unique and rich, you know, archaeological resources. But even the history part is quite old as well.
So while we're celebrating this colonial era of Florida, the native population of 500 years ago might not be so thankful. They were here, what, for 12,000 years, mm-hmm. is it, before?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And how do you address that aspect of it?
Certainly. Certainly we want to tell that part of the story, too. You know, the Spanish...
Introducing the disease and...
Correct. You know, for better or for worse, when the Spanish arrived, they did provide us with the only written documentation that we have, you know, about what they encountered when they came here. And they describe, you know, the rich culture and architecture and you know, ceremonies that were here. But which, as archaeologists, we try to augment that written history with the archaeological record. And sometimes it tells us the same story, and oftentimes it tells us a different story.
Dr. Williams, tell us more about Viva Florida 500 and how it was organized and some of the other events that are going on.
Well, this is a statewide initiative that was started back in January, and the goal of this was to commemorate not just that moment 500 years ago when the Spanish came to Florida for the first time, but the subsequent 500 years of history and culture and people and change that's happened. And so if you go to the Viva Florida 500 website, they actually have, you know, everything from the Daytona 500 to our events coming up this weekend. And it's a great place to go and see what the history and the culture of Florida is and be able to plan a vacation or be able to plan a day trip around Florida.
I find that the June 20th cemetery business that we were talking about earlier, the Cemetery Resource Preservation Training, actually the acronym is CRIPT.
Exactly. And Sarah Miller, who's the director of my organization up in St. Augustine, developed this, and her specialty within archaeology is actually historic cemetery preservation. And so she's actually going to be coming down to Key West to help us do this training, and it's an interesting perspective to look at cemeteries across Florida and how different the communities treat them and respect them or don't respect them, given, you know, the individual community.
Melissa Memory, tell me, I'm sorry, how did the yes? Seminole Wars affect history in the Keys and the Tortugas? Did it have any effect?
Not so much in the Tortugas. You know, certainly there were some pretty significant events, particularly at Indian Key, which basically
right.
the events where Chiquica went and, you know, attacked Henry Perrine on Indian
right.
Key, which started the Third Seminole War. So that was a pretty significant event.
What was behind the building of Fort Jefferson?
Well, despite the fact, as I said, when you come there, it's hard to imagine why this fort is there. During the Age of Sail, it was... basically a safe parking lot for ships, as it were, as a safe harbor that was strategically, you know, at the end of the Florida Keys and provided a place for staging or, you know, going south to Cuba or, you know, to Florida. But certainly they felt like that not only was it important strategically for the U.S., but it would be terrible if it fell into enemy hands, because that would...
Being Spanish
or other enemies.
What is this hidden history of the Dry Tortugas?
Well, as archaeologists, you know, we often, when you go out there, you see Fort Jefferson and, you know, the obvious things, but hidden below the water hidden below the ground is the archaeological record. And what we do is try to uncover and reveal that archaeological record that tells that different story.
Human records.
Human records.
Do you do digs there?
We do. Michelle and I actually did a public archaeology program out there a few years ago, focused on the construction village that was out there pretty much during the whole duration of the construction.
It's Topical Currents, and we're speaking with Dr. Michelle Williams. She directs the Florida Public Archaeology Network at FAU, Florida Atlantic University, and Melissa Memory, Chief of Cultural Resources for Everglades and Dry Tortugas National Park. We're speaking about Viva Florida 500. The website is vivafl500.org.
I believe so.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. We need to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. We're joined by Dr. Michelle Williams and Melissa Memory. If you'd like to join in the conversation, you're welcome to 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email radio at WLRN.org. And Twitter, Bonnie,
is at Topical Currents. And what is, you know, I've heard this refuted that St. Augustine is the nation's oldest community. Was it a town in Virginia?
Oh, actually, the people in Pensacola and the people in St. Augustine have had this fight for some, we'll say almost 500 years. There was an attempt by the Spanish to put a community into Pensacola, and unfortunately it was hit by a series of hurricanes and was not a successful community. So the way that we like to politically correctly put it is that St. Augustine had the first successful European colonization of the New World, of the United States.
Wasn't there a big massacre there early on near St. Augustine?
I think that any time you talk about Native Americans and the colonial period, you're talking about a big massacre somewhere.
Dr. Williams, tell us more about the FAU Archaeology Network.
The Florida Public Archaeology Network, and my office is at FAU, but we're a statewide organization. And our full-time job is doing education and outreach to help tell people about the archaeology of Florida so we can preserve the archaeology of Florida. And we do that through public lectures or events like this that we're doing in the upcoming week, and also helping individual communities develop preservation ordinances so that it's not just what the people care about, but also on a government level that it's being legislated.
And Melissa, as Chief of Cultural Resources for Everglades National Park, as well as Dry Tortugas National Park, what do you do?
Some mornings I ask myself that same question. despite the fact that most people think of the Everglades as being, the rich natural landscape that it is, it also has a very rich human history as well. We have over 250 documented archaeological sites, and the expectation that there's lots of other archaeological sites besides that. These include really extensive shell work sites in the 10,000 Islands area, some of which are 60 acres in site, and include things you might associate with, you know, the mound builders to the north, or even Central America, mounds, plazas, water courts, and those sorts of things. We also have the Nike missile site, which is a Cold War era Nike missile site that was stood up during the Cuban Missile Crisis that we have active interpretation on.
I remember people, old-timers, talking about seeing missiles in truck beds.
Yes.
Going down south through Homestead and that.
Mm-hmm. It was a scary time, certainly, during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
How far back does human history go in the Everglades?
Well, we only have dates to right currently to about 6,500 years before present, which is about the age of the Everglades. But in the Color Ridge site, which is by the Deering Estate, we have, you know, over 10,000 years of human history documented.
The what site?
Cutler Ridge.
Cutler Ridge. Okay.
Yeah,
oh.
Cutler Fossil Site.
Mm-hmm. So if people want to attend these events, then what do they do?
Well, of course, Dry Tortugas, there's a limited only a couple of options to getting out to the Dry Tortugas. One is the Yankee Freedom 3, which is a co-sponsor of this event, which leaves every morning from Key West, and it's a 2.5-hour ferry ride out to the Dry Tortugas, 2.5 hours back. And then there's also a seaplane that leaves from daily, if the weather permitting, from the airport.
Or you could water ski.
Yes.
And I was just talking to some very nice gentlemen at the Biscayne Bay Yacht Club, and they actually were planning on bringing some of their boats down there. So, you know, any listeners with boats big enough to get to the Dry Tortugas are more than welcome to come as well.
Okay.
And once again, a thumbnail, Dr. Williams, of the events starting June 20th.
June 20th, we have a cemetery resource preservation training that will be going on. The 21st will be the event at the Dry Tortugas. The 22nd will be a lecture series that will be in Key West at the Echo Discovery Center. And they can find more information about all of these at flpublicarchaeology.org.
Dr. Williams, tell us a little bit more about the Museum of Florida History in Tallahassee and some of the artifacts that they have there.
They have an amazing collection that represents this 10,000 years of history that people have lived here, and they recently have been doing a lot of work on the canoes that were made by prehistoric peoples here in Florida, which, as we all know, to talk about Florida is to talk about water, and it's very humanizing to see that history go back thousands of years where people's relationship with the state of Florida was through the water.
Well, we certainly appreciate you coming on and talking about Viva Florida 500. We've been speaking with Dr. Michelle Williams. She directs the Florida Public Archaeology Network at Florida Atlantic University. And also we want to thank Melissa Memory. She's the Chief of Cultural Resources for Everglades and Dry Tortugas National Parks. Thanks to you both, and the best for your project.
Thanks. I hope it all goes well.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Food and Dining up next. And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Bonnie and I always like these Thursday editions. It's sort of like the beginning of our weekend.
That's true. And it also sometimes has delicacies.
And especially today. And we're joined by my longtime friend, chef, author, syndicated columnist Linda Gastenheimer. I haven't called her the lunch goddess in a while, so I'll bring that up today. Linda, Sunday is Father's Day, often a time for family cookouts, so what's up your sleeve today?
Oh, have we got our sleeve up today, let me tell you. And you are having a very nice lunch
indeed
today.
Indeed.
He's having an early Father's Day, Linda.
There you go. All right, coming up this weekend. So, what does Dad love? Well, usually it's steak. And usually it's a big steak.
It's a stereotype, but we'll go along with it, right?
I saw you gobbling the steak. Okay, so how do you choose the right cut? And what's the best way to cook it? And a constant question, how do I know when it's ready? Well, our guest today is an expert. He's Chef Jose Mandine, and he's the chef partner at Pub Belly Restaurant Group, and especially at PB Steak. So welcome, Jose Mandine.
Hi, how are you?
Great to have you with us, especially
he's got his Miami Heat cap on also.
Yeah, we hope it brings us
hope
luck
that's
tonight.
Good luck, huh?
Yeah, right,
yes.
Exactly. Well, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any steak questions or comments for our guests? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Do we have email, Bonnie?
We do, radio@WLRN.org, and you can also tweet us at Topical Currents.
Okay, great. Also with us, of course, our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and you can read his wine column in today's Miami Herald. Fred, are we drinking today, or is that a non-question?
That is a non-question. The question is, what is the stereotypical accompaniment for red meat? And, of course, it is
Cabernet.
Red wine, that's right. Very okay. Good.
It's your happy day, Fred. Okay, and we also have a special guest in our studio today, Bonnie.
We do. Just a little background. We were doing, Joe and I were doing our gardening, at your service gardening show on Monday, was it?
I guess.
Lose track of the days. Monday, or, okay, Monday. And somebody called in and told us about her Everglades tomatoes that she grows, and her name is Kristen Bjornson. And so Joe said, why don't you bring some of your tomatoes on Food and Dining on Thursday? Call Bonnie. So the next morning...
I always try and push things off on
yes,
you.
So the next morning, indeed, I had an email from Kristen. And so we invited her on the show with her tomatoes.
We've got them
and
right here.
They are...
They're adorable. How big would you say, how would you describe these little round circles?
They're smaller than a grape, but bigger than a pea, I guess.
They're like dime-sized.
Dime-sized, that's what I would say.
Okay, little cute little round things.
Well, and we really appreciate you bringing those.
Yes, so Kristen Bjornson is joining
and
us
and also
in the
brought us mulberries.
Right. So, Kristen, let me ask you something. First of all, finally, I'm tasting a tomato that tastes like one. So where did you get these? Well, what are they?
I bought them from David McLean at Trinity Churchside Garden in Fort Lauderdale, just off of Andrews Avenue. He's a plant guru, and he has a lot of cool native plants. And I put one in a grow bag, and it did okay, but some must have fallen out and reseeded. And I have plants that are like 6 feet tall now. They're tremendous. By accident. They're wonderful.
And how do you like care that? For them? Do you get pests?
I use some a dust called diatomaceous earth, and I use like a sprayer, and I keep the worms off and some dish soap occasionally for vigorous worms.
What she told me is, Mrs. Non-Green Thumb here, that if I just put it in the ground, the tomato itself, it'll grow.
They really like our sandy Florida soil. And I guess the calcium in the soil.
Here you go, Bonnie.
And the limestone.
Thank you.
Joe just took them away from me.
Yes. we've absconded with the...
But when are we going to start talking about steak?
Okay, all right. Now, from tomatoes to steak... Now, Jose's eating them. From tomatoes to steak, Jose Mandine. Steak is your business. There's so many different cuts. What are the best ones for quick cooking or for grilling?
The best ones are the most known ones, as the ribeye or the New Year's strip. In Miami, it's very famous, the skirt steak, or the churrasco, which is very good for grilling and quick. My favorite is the ribeye, for sure.
Oh, the ribeye has
it
the
bone. It has more marbling.
And,
yes.
And the fat.
I have, yeah.
Of course.
No, we call it marbling, not fat. Right, Fred?
Right.
Absolutely.
Okay. Sometimes I get very confused because... Legally, on the labels, they have to put a certain legal name. And then I'm not quite sure if that is what I think it is.
Well, the label is what the USDA gives it. So it goes from all the way from choice to prime. The prime obviously has the most marbling, and it's going to be the most expensive. But there's a lot of steaks between choice and prime that you can buy that will give you a great tasting steak. Like the certified Angus beef.
Now, this is what we're eating here.
Yeah.
Lucky for us.
Mm-hmm.
This is so delicious. It's juicy, and the sauces. But, well, first of all, how did you cook this? It's a New York strip.
It's a New York strip, yeah.
How did you cook it so that it's juicy and just slightly pink inside, a nice crust on the outside, and I'm drooling?
Yeah, it's one of the most important things cooking a steak is the crust for me. We grill it in a wood fire grill to give it that oaky taste and the wood taste, and then we finish it in a broiler, in a very at a 1500 degree broiler. If you don't have that at home, you can always give it a nice seared with a grill, or you know it's very
so you get a nice sear on it for what, a minute or two, just so it's not,
yeah,
got that
until
crust.
You get a nice crust to the steak,
and then finish cooking it. Sometimes I'll sear it. And then I'll put it in like a 200-degree oven for an hour.
I think that's too much. I mean, you want to cook it in a hotter oven, 380, 350 degrees, so you can finish it. Then let the steak rest. To get a juicy steak, you don't want to go more than medium. I prefer medium rare. That's for me the perfect steak.
And what number on your thermometer is medium rare?
You want a rare, it's going to be 119 degrees inside. If you want it to be medium rare, it's going to be 123, 125. If you want it to be medium, it's going to be 130, 135. If you go way past that, you're talking about medium well, 145, and then you go 160, it's a completely well-cooked, well-done steak.
Okay, sure, so what about carry-on cooking? I mean, so do you take it off before it reaches that temperature?
I mean, everything carry-on's cooking, but what steak does is when you grill a steak and you finish cooking it, you let it rest for at least 2 minutes, and what happens is all the fluids and all the blood are going to go in the middle of the steak. It's going to make it juicy, and it's not going to let it bleed when you slice into it.
So when it's cooking, all the juices run to the edge of the steak, and then when you let it rest, it goes back into the center.
Exactly, making it really juicy.
Mm. Jose, when you're doing a steak on the grill, do you flip it only once, or do you flip it back and forth?
Well, some people like to give it the diamond marks. So you want to flip it once only. You cook it one side, you cook it the other side.
That's better for getting a crust.
You don't want to be playing around with it because that's gonna hurt the middle of the steak. And one side is gonna be cooked more than the other.
And also, if how do you keep the steak from sticking to the grill?
No, steaks don't stick to the grill because they have enough fat that eventually they will release from the grill.
So leave it there.
You don't
so
need
that
to put
releases.
Oil. You don't need to put butter. You don't need to put anything. Eventually, the protein itself will release the fat that it will stick out of the grill.
And is there anything wrong with basting it in butter?
Oh, that's a good point because previous steak we do that and we have
maybe some garlic butter.
Yeah, we make our own basting. Makes it a lot juicier from the outside. And we do that with butter and beef fat, and we render it down with shallots and herbs, and we baste the steak while we're cooking it.
You just made a friend for life.
Now, if I want to make a London broil on the grill, what cut should I use and how thick should it be?
I mean, London broil on the grill, you do a top sirloin, but, I mean, I wouldn't do that on the grill. Unless you want to cover it for a long time, I would just do it more in an oven or...
Because it's too tough to.
Yeah, it's too tough.
So bacon.
Bacon you can do on the grill for sure. Grill, you want to leave grilling for steak that are more faster on cooking.
And now we have these wonderful sauces in front of us. There's a green one and a brown one and a deep dark color one. And these sauces are so good on the steak. What are they?
Well, those are some of the sauces that we serve with our steaks. And we make with a PB steak. We take a play on a classic steakhouse for the Bernays. We use shiso Bernays, which is a Japanese leaf. We do a truffle soy sauce.
Stop. Truffle soy sauce.
Yes.
So what's
which one is that? The brownish one.
Yeah.
But this is beautifully thick. So you put soy sauce and real truffles.
Yeah, we infuse soy sauce with truffle peelings, and then we emulsify it with olive oil, and then use some yuzu juice and some rice wine vinegar.
Oh, no wonder. And then there's a third sauce here.
The third sauce is just basically pickled mustard juice.
That's the green one?
That's the black one.
The black,
one.
And
it's okay if I stick my finger in there?
Yeah, of course.
You already did.
And for that sauce, we actually reduced some bourbon also.
No wonder. Yeah. As he goes on, he tells, it's just this and this, and then he goes on with all the other... elements. And
you got to sell it first before you actually sell it.
Okay. So let me ask you more about the steaks. Are there some less expensive cuts of steak that maybe we don't know about, but they're quick grilling steaks or quick cooking steaks?
One of my favorites is the hanger steak. The hanger steak, everybody knows that's a butcher steak because it's this the cut that the butcher will take home because he couldn't sell back in the day.
And there's only one small one in each...
It's so tender, it's so good. If you cook the steak more than medium, you're not gonna thank me. You know, you have to be medium rare to medium. The steak, if you overcook it, it's gonna taste completely different than if you cook
it. So it's hard to buy a hanger steak, though, if we want to.
I think hanger steak is becoming very popular now, and you're gonna see it more in supermarkets and butcher shops.
I find the chuck eyes are very good and inexpensive also.
Chuck eye, a flank steak. Mm-hmm. And skirt steaks is a very popular, like I said before.
So those are the cuts that we should be looking for.
Yeah.
For less expensive. Okay. Now, let's talk. You talked a bit about prime. And is it worth getting the prime as opposed to the choice? Now, prime because it has more marbling in it, which Joe would love. And that's what he puts his butter on.
Yeah, I mean, prime beef is I mean, it's very tasty, but it's very expensive. So if you want to spend the money on it, I mean, you're gonna enjoy it for sure. But there are steaks that are very comparable to that, that you don't have to pay that much money for.
No, what are they?
Like I told you, the certified Angus beef program is amazing. And there's a lot of black Angus beef out there and Angus beef that will give you just a little bit less than prime. And actually, when it's time to separate them, you know, sometimes some prime beef goes into the Angus program.
Does your restaurant deal with any of the Kobe or Wagyu beef?
Right now, we have a Kobe beef, a Wagyu beef style from Florida, from Jackman Ranch.
Oh, is that right?
Yes. And they actually mixed a Angus and a red Kobe cow from Japan. And they made this mix, and now we're having the first Florida Wagyu.
Wow. Now, let's talk for a minute about grass-fed beef, because that's coming into the supermarkets now. First of all, my question is, I know it's supposed to be eating grass, but do they finish it up with corn or something? Are these grass-fed beef really grass-fed?
Yeah, that's what all day is grass. I mean, it's very popular in South America.
In Argentina.
In Argentina and Uruguay especially.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, I love the flavor of it, but I'm more into a corn-fed beef than grass-fed.
That's what we're used to.
Yeah, that's what we're used to.
But does it take long? It's tougher, a little tougher. So would you cook it longer?
It's a little tougher because the meat definitely has less marbling and less fat than corn-fed.
So how would you suggest cooking it?
The same way. You cook it the same way.
Same way.
Yeah.
Just to put it on the fire and
grill it. And just the same way you would do any steak.
During your restaurant's opening hours, how do most people order their steak? What's the most popular doneness degree?
I think medium rare. In our restaurant, it's the most popular. After that, will be medium, and then, you know, medium well.
What happens if someone orders a filet mignon and wants it well done?
Well, usually...
then sends it back because it's burned.
Usually, yeah, if somebody wants a filet mignon well done, usually we recommend that we butterfly it. Because if not, it's gonna
take... you could put it in the deep fryer.
Or we could put it in the deep fryer. No, we don't do that.
Well, Linda, we are talking all about steak, but are we going to get to the other?
The other, but let's go first to Paul.
Okay.
Okay, in Fort Lauderdale, and then we'll get to that other that you loved.
We also have people want more information from Kristen about how to get those tomato seeds.
Okay, well, let's
we'll get to
Paul.
That.
Paul, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Linda. Joe's always in a better mood when you're there, by the way.
Thank you.
I come from up north, you'll notice by my accent, but one thing I can't find down here, and it doesn't make any sense to me, is steak tips. And everybody says sirloin, but I don't find that same flavor like I had up north, those, you know, sirloin tips.
Sirloin tips. Can we find them here?
I haven't seen them at supermarkets, but I can get them, but...
What is it, actually? What part of the beef or the cow is it?
It's just the tip of the sirloin. I mean...
It's the end.
The small end.
You're looking to smoke it or you're looking to grill it?
To grill it, but I mean, they were a big thing up north, and I don't understand why they don't sell it down here. It just, I've heard other people ask about it, too, and I just never... I don't understand why they don't sell it.
Okay, well, he's shaking his head, and he doesn't know why they don't
so
sell it.
So I guess you can go to a specialty butcher and ask.
Go to a specialty butcher shop, they will get it for you.
Well, you know what?
Okay.
Let's ask somebody
Thank
to
so
call
much.
In. We'll ask
Thank
somebody
you.
To call in. If we get the answer, we'll give it on air. And I think before Bonnie will get to your question, we have somebody asking a question about Kristen.
Sure.
What did she want to have?
Information about how she can get
the seeds
to be able
the,
to... Either the seeds or plants, I suppose.
I'm happy to give you some to whomever, you know, wants them. I bought mine from David McLean.
You might
McLean.
Be opening up a...
Yeah, a can of worms.
Can of worms.
Hopefully
Say
no
again
worms.
Who you
no
bought
worms.
Them from.
David McLean at Trinity Churchside Garden in Fort Lauderdale. It's off of Andrews Avenue, just north of Davie Boulevard.
Would these seeds be for sale, like in a seed packet?
I've looked online and I found some. I'm not sure. I can't vouch for any.
So if you Google Everglades tomatoes, you're going to get
exactly. I found some store in West Palm that has them, but other than that, David is the only guy I know.
Bonnie, You wanted to talk about those Brussels sprouts.
Well, those Brussels sprouts.
Yes. Just quickly.
Those Brussels sprouts. Okay, Jose.
Give us the...
Those are nice.
The secret of the Brussels sprouts.
I mean, the secret of the Brussels sprouts is to cook them with... We cook them with bacon and...
That's a big secret.
That is a big secret I wish I hadn't known.
And we have it's a miso sauce. So basically, the miso sauce is pretty sweet, and with the smokiness of the bacon and the sweetness...
Miso.
Fermented soybean. Between the sweetness of the miso and the smokiness of the bacon, you know, tossed with the roasted Brussels sprouts,
So first you boil the Brussels sprouts and then you toast them? Or no, then you sauté them.
Yeah, with the sauté.
Because they've got a nice crust on them.
Yeah.
You cut them in half.
Yeah.
And you boil them or roast them? You roast them.
Yeah, we roast them. We don't boil them.
Oh, first you roast them and then you sauté them.
That's the thing. We don't boil them because we don't want them to get watery.
Okay, well, I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and my guest is Chef Jose Mendin. He's the chef partner at the PB Pub Belly Group, correct? And at PB Steak. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and our guest today is Chef Jose Mendin. He's the chef partner at the Pub Belly Group. And he's at PB Steak, and he's been giving us these wonderful tips on how to buy and cook the perfect steak for any day, but especially for Father's Day.
Except for the tips.
And also, Kristen Bjornsson has been with us with these Everglade tomatoes, sharing them with us. They're just absolutely delicious. By the way, Jose, do you have anything special going on for Father's Day?
Yeah, we're doing a Father's Day brunch. It's a $55 menu, and you get to try at least almost seven dishes to share, and you get dessert, and you also get unlimited mimosas, micheladas, and Bloody Marys.
All right, and that's to share at $55.
What was the second drink?
Michelada. Michelada is basically it's a Mexican drink.
Oh, I see.
And they do it the beer with spices, and it's really good.
It's $55 a person.
Yeah.
Okay, so now dinner in minutes. It's dinner in minutes time, and today's it's another steak for Dad. This is a steak and portobello mushroom sandwich, and it has a tapenade with tomatoes, another tomato thing here. It's Dad's day. Put away the grill. Let him relax. And this steak with meaty portobello mushrooms and sweet onions are just all sautéed in a pan. And then there's a balsamic vinegar and garlic marinade. That also becomes a dipping sauce. Very simple. Marinate the steak and the mushrooms. Then you save that marinade and you sauté the steak and mushrooms and the onions. And then you take that out of the pan and you put the marinade in. Boil that for a few minutes. Slice the steak. Fill the toasted rolls with it. Serve it with the dipping sauce. And your dad will be happy and so will you because it's a one pan dish. And then just slice up some tomatoes and spoon a little olive tapenade on top. That recipe.
Might be kind of tough to slice these Everglades tomatoes.
You just pop those in your mouth. Just pop them in your mouth. that recipe and a photo is at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred Tasker, are we drinking?
We are drinking. We may not know what women want, as Freud would say, but we know very well what men want. Right, Joe?
I assume. Where are you taking me?
Well, I mean, men want red meat on Father's Day, of course, and they want red wine. Please don't listen to those TV ads. Don't serve Daddy a prize grill-marked 2-inch thick porterhouse and then hand him a 55-calorie light beer. I mean, oh. And don't give him a light-bodied red wine either. I was once served a Beaujolais red wine with a steak, and it was the worst combination in the world. And I like Beaujolais, but not with steak. So if you're grilling a big, fat piece of red meat for Father's Day, give Pop a big, fat, rich, full-bodied, hearty, stick-to-your-ribs California Cabernet Sauvignon. Cab has the tannins, the acid, and the oomph to stand up to a well-marbled, grilled New York strip or ribeye. And Linda, I would say don't put away the grill. I think the mommy ought to get out and do the grilling this year, don't you think?
Okay, the way you do it in the summer here?
That patented Tasker barbecue business.
Right. You turn up the air conditioning and bring the grill close to the house?
Yeah, and get a very, very cold glass of champagne and have that air conditioning pouring on your back. Of course, now that I'm in Michigan, I don't have to do that. I can just go outside.
All right, we won't talk
but
about
anyway,
winter.
But anyway, the wine doesn't have to be expensive. I tried the 2011 Edna Valley Cabernet Sauvignon from Paso Robles, California, with a steak the other day, and it was great. Firm acids and tannins and nice flavors of anise and black raspberries, and it was only $15. But while we're on Cabernet Sauvignon, let me make another suggestion. The Edna Valley Cab that's in the market now is from 2011, and that's really too young to drink a Cabernet Sauvignon. The other day, I drank a William Hill Cabernet from 2003, so it was 10 years old, and it was just spectacular. The fruit was still there, but the acids and tannins had softened into a smooth, opulent, rich, super rich wonderfulness. And I know, in especially in South Florida, it's hard to sell our wines because it's so hot. So I would suggest trying this. Buy three bottles of the same new Cabernet Sauvignon. Put them in the bottom of an interior closet where they'll be away from light and vibration, and keep them as much as you can from wide temperature swings. And then after about 4 or 5 years, open one of the bottles and see what it's like. If it's okay.
God willing.
Yeah, that's right. If it's okay, open the next one in 7 years and the final one in 10 years.
Okay.
Just see what you think, and then let me know. Put it on your calendar. Give me a call when you get to that 10-year mark.
Does that need to be an air-conditioned closet?
Oh, yeah. Not in South Florida, it sure does.
Okay. Well, thank you, Fred Tasker. We have Charles in Coral Gables. Charles, you have some information for us?
Yes, hi, everybody, and thanks for taking my call. Love your show today. Steaks is my favorite subject of food. Just wanted to say that definitely a Cabernet is the best with steak. I was in the Santa Cruz Mountains not too long ago in a little restaurant where they served a what they called a big red Cabernet with a great steak, and we're sitting outdoors in the redwood forest, and it was just an amazing. And it actually comes from a little winery in the Santa Cruz Mountains that produces the big red. And now the some of the better stores here, in at least in Coral Gables, South Miami, are actually stocking the big red. It's become very popular.
Well, Charles, what about the
sirloin tips? Are we going to tell us about that?
Sure. As far as the steak's concerned, is you can definitely find the sirloin tips at Publix. My wife gets it all the time. She actually, when we have steak on a normal basis, that's the first thing she buys. You know, unless we want an expensive cut and all that. But yeah, Publix will actually have it already packaged, or you can ask the butcher at any Publix store to cut you the.
Okay.
The sirloin tips, and it's fantastic.
Well, great tips. Thank you very much. And we have. Thank you for your call. And we have Manny in Coral Gables. Do you have sirloin tip steaks?
Yes. Hi, how you doing?
Great.
Good show, by the way.
Thanks.
My name's Manny, and I get my stuff from a place called Gourmet at Your Door. It's a great place. They have Wagyu beef, grass-fed beef as well, and Kobe and Higher Choice. And I get my tenderloin tips and my sirloin tips from them. They deliver to your door.
Okay. Oh, they do. So, and where are they located?
They're actually a home delivery service. They go to your door with their vehicles and with everything, all the merchandise that you ask for. I believe their phone number is 305-252-3096.
Do you own it? Do you own it?
No, I don't actually, no.
And what's the name of it, Manny?
Gourmet at Your Door.
Oh, okay.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for your call.
Hello,
thanks
West
for that tip. Thank you. Well, we're nearly out of time.
Well, and Kristen also had a suggestion for the sirloin tips.
I think they sell them at Penn Dutch. I saw it for sale a few weeks ago.
Okay. At Penn Dutch, and that's located in?
They have two locations. I visit the one in Hollywood, and I believe they have one in Coral Springs.
Okay. Great. Well, it's been really a very, very, very tasty week. We didn't even get to the rest of the food that Chef brought with us, not only the Brussels sprouts and the steak.
The ceviche.
The ceviche in the taco shells.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And then we had the little sliders. They were...
tenderloin tartare sliders.
Tuna tartare sliders?
Tenderloin.
Tenderloin tartare sliders. Oh, my goodness. Well, we're almost out of time.
A little too sophisticated for me, I think.
Thank you, Chef Jose Mendine. He's the chef...
You.
partner at Pub Belly Group and PB Steak, located on Purdy Avenue on Miami Beach. And thank you, Kristen Bjornson, for sharing your Everglade tomatoes with us.
Will you be making steak this Sunday, Linda?
There's a possibility.
On the grill?
On the grill.
We'll see. So anyway, Everglade tomatoes, they're really, really special. And thank you for sharing.
Yes, thank you.
And
very
also
much.
The mulberries.
Thank you, Kristen.
Little mulberries, too. Well, next week we'll be talking with Richard Campbell. He's the director of Tropical Fruit Program at Fairchild Tropical Gardens. We'll talk about Mango Madness and the Fairchild Gardens Mango Festival. I love it every year.
I always like those mango programs.
Oh, boy. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
Thanks, Linda.
And that wraps up this edition. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Also, more information and links to the Topical Currents Facebook page. Today's recipe at dinnerinminutes.com. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. Monday, we return with a topic we all try and avoid. Attorney Scott Taylor Smith has written, When Someone Dies, the Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. And the calendar on this day in 1865, 148 years ago, the birth of poet William Butler Yeats in Dublin, the first Irishman to win a Nobel Prize in 1923. He dabbled in the occult and automatic writing. He died in France in 1939. And on this day in 1963, 50 years ago, the death of activist and martyr Medgar Evers, shot in the driveway of his Jackson, Mississippi home. He was the field secretary for the NAACP. He's buried in Arlington Cemetery. One more while we choose to remain silent. On this day, 1966, 47 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court issues its decision in Miranda versus the state of Arizona. Arrestees have the right to remain silent until an attorney is present. The Roberts Court tweaked it in 2010. And we leave with lines from Yeats, his poem, He Wishes from the Cloths of Heaven. But I, being poor, have only my dreams. I have spread my dreams under your feet. Tread softly, because you tread on my dreams. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.